A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. Dedicatory Letter and Introduction. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Dedicatory Letter. To Monsieur Talleyrand Perigord, former Bishop of Oton. Sir, having read with great pleasure a pamphlet on national education that you recently published, I dedicate this volume to you, to induce you to reconsider the subject and maturely weigh what I shall say about the rights of woman and national education. And I'm calling with a firm tone of humanity. In these arguments, sir, I am not trying to get anything for myself. I plead not for myself, but for my sex. My own personal wants, anyway, amount to very little. For many years I have regarded independence as the great blessing of life, the basis of every virtue. And even if I end up living on a barren heath, I will always guarantee my independence by contracting my wants. So it is my affection for the whole human race that makes my pen speed along to support what I believe to be the cause of virtue, and leads me to long to see woman's place in the world enable her to advance the progress of the glorious principles that give a substance to morality, rather than holding them back. My opinion about the rights and duties of woman seems to flow so naturally from those simple principles that it seems almost inevitable that some of the enlarged minds who formed your admirable constitution will agree with me. Knowledge is spread more widely in France than in any other part of Europe, and I attribute this in large measure to the social intercourse there has long been in France between the sexes. It is true, I am going to speak freely, that in France the very essence of sensuality has been extracted for the pleasure of the voluptuary, and a kind of sentimental lust has prevailed. This, together with the system of deceptiveness that the whole spirit of their political and civil government taught, have given a sinister sort of knowingness to the French character, and a polish of manners that injures the substance by driving sincerity out of society. And modesty, the fairest garb of virtue, has been more grossly insulted in France than even in England. The minimal attention to decency that even brutes instinctively observe is regarded by Frenchwomen as prudish. Manners and morals are so closely related that they have often been confused with one another. But although manners should be only the natural reflection of morals, when various causes have produced unnatural and corrupt manners that infect even the young, morality becomes an empty name. Personal restraint and respect for cleanliness and delicacy in domestic life are the graceful pillars of modesty, but Frenchwomen almost despise them. If the pure flame of patriotism has reached their hearts, they should work to improve the morals of their fellow citizens by teaching men not only to respect modesty in women, but to become modest themselves, as the only way to deserve women's respect. Fighting for the rights of women, my main argument is built on this simple principle. If woman isn't fitted by education to become man's companion, she will stop the progress of knowledge. Because truth must be common to all. If it isn't, it won't be able to influence how people in general behave. And how can woman be expected to cooperate if she doesn't know why she ought to be virtuous? If freedom doesn't strengthen her reason until she understands her duty and sees how it relates to her real good? If children are to be brought up to understand the true principle of patriotism, their mother must be a patriot, and the love of mankind, from which an orderly sequence of virtues arises, can be produced only by attending to the moral and civil interest of mankind. But the upbringing and situation of woman at present shuts her out from such investigations. In this work, I have produced many arguments that I found conclusive, showing that the prevailing notion of the female character is subversive of morality. I have contended that to make the human body and mind more perfect, chastity must more universally prevail, and that chastity will never be respected in the male world until the person of a woman is not virtually idolized while the woman has little virtue or sense. Consider these remarks dispassionately, sir, for you seemed to have a glimpse of this truth when you said that to see one half of the human race excluded by the other half from all participation of government is a political phenomenon that can't possibly be explained according to abstract principles. If that is so, what does your constitution rest on? If the abstract rights of man can stand discussion and explanation, those of woman, by a parity of reasoning, won't shrink from the same test, though a different view prevails in this country, built on the very arguments that you use to justify the oppression of woman, prescription. I address you as a legislator. When men fight for their freedom, fight to be allowed to judge for themselves concerning their own happiness, isn't it inconsistent and unjust to hold women down? I know that you firmly believe you are acting in the manner most likely to promote women's happiness, but who made man the exclusive judge of that, if woman shares with him the gift of reason? Tyrants of every kind, from the weak king to the weak father of a family, use this same argument that it is in your own best interests. They are all eager to crush reason, but they always say that they usurp reason's throne only to be useful. Isn't that what you are doing, when you force all women, by denying them civil and political rights, to remain walled in by their families and groping in the dark? Surely, sir, you won't say that a duty can be binding without being founded on reason. Arguments for civil and political rights can be drawn from reason, and with that splendid support, the more understanding women acquire, the more they will be attached to their duty, understanding it. Unless they understand it, unless their morals are based on the same immutable principles as those of man, no authority can make them act virtuously. They may be convenient slaves, but slavery will have its constant effect, degrading the master and the abject dependent. If you are going to exclude women, without consulting them, from sharing in the natural rights of mankind, then defend yourself against accusations of injustice and inconsistency by proving that women don't have reason. If you don't do that, then this flaw in your new constitution, the first constitution based on reason, will show for all times that man must in some way act like a tyrant, and that tyranny, in whatever part of society it raises its arrogant head, will always undermine morality. I have produced what seem to me to be irrefutable arguments, drawn from matters of fact, to prove my often repeated assertion that women cannot by force be confined to domestic concerns. However ignorant they are, they will get involved in more weighty affairs, neglecting private duties, only to disturb by cunning tricks the orderly plans of reason that rise above their comprehension. Also, while women are only made to acquire personal accomplishments, men will seek pleasure in variety, and faithless husbands will make faithless wives. Indeed, such ignorant beings as wives are, in such a system, will be very excusable when, not having been taught to respect public good or allowed any civil rights, they try to make things more fair by retaliation. When the box of mischief has been thus opened in society, what is to preserve private virtue, the only security of public freedom and universal happiness? The answer is, let there be no coercion established in society, no laws that force people into this or that social role or situation. When that is achieved, the common law of gravity will hold sway, and the sexes will fall into their proper places. With fairer laws forming your citizens, marriage can become more sacred. Your young men can choose wives from motives of affection, and your maidens can allow love to root out vanity. The father of a family won't weaken his constitution and debase his sentiments by visiting prostitutes. He won't, in obeying the call of sexual appetite, forget the purpose for which it was implanted in him. And the mother won't neglect her children to practice the arts of teasing and flirting when sense and modesty secure her the friendship of her husband. But until men become attentive to the duty of a father, you can't expect women to spend in their nursery the time that they choose to spend at their mirror. For this exercise in cunning is only a natural instinct to enable them to obtain indirectly a little of the power of which they are unjustly denied a share. If women aren't permitted to enjoy legitimate rights, they will seek illicit privileges in ways that make both men and themselves vicious. I wish, sir, to get some investigations of this kind going in France. If they lead to a confirmation of my principles, then, when your constitution is revised, the rights of woman may be respected, if it has been fully proved that reason calls for this respect, and loudly demands justice for one half of the human race. I am, sir, yours respectfully, M.W. Introduction. After thinking about the sweep of history, and viewing the present world with anxious care, I find my spirits depressed by the most melancholy emotions of sorrowful indignation. I have had to admit, sadly, that either nature has made a great difference between man and man, or that the world is not yet anywhere near to being fully civilized. I have looked into various books on education, and patiently observed the conduct of parents and the management of schools, but all this has given me is a deep conviction that the neglected education of my fellow creatures is the main source of the misery I deplore, and that women in particular are made weak and wretched by a number of cooperating causes, originating from one hasty conclusion. The conduct and manners of women, in fact, show clearly that their minds are not in a healthy state. As with flowers planted in soil that is too rich, strength and usefulness are sacrificed to beauty, and the flamboyant leaves, after giving pleasure to viewers, fade on the stalk, disregarded, long before it was the time for them to reach maturity. This barren blooming is caused partly by a false system of education, gathered from the books on the subject by men. These writers, regarding females as women, rather than as human creatures, have been more concerned to make them alluring mistresses than affectionate wives and rational mothers. And this homage to women's attractions has distorted their understanding to such an extent that almost all the civilized women of the present century are anxious only to inspire love, when they ought to have the nobler aim of getting respect for their abilities and virtues. In a book on female rights and manners, therefore, the works written specifically for their improvement mustn't be overlooked, especially when the book says explicitly that women's minds are weakened by false refinement, that the books of instruction written by men of genius have been as likely to do harm as more frivolous productions are, and that, when improvable reason is regarded as the dignity that raises men above the lower animal and puts a natural sceptre in a feeble hand, those instructive works regard woman, in true Moslem fashion, as beings of a subordinate kind, and not as a part of the human species. But don't think that because I am a woman, I mean to stir up violently the debated question about the equality and inferiority of the female sex. But that topic does lie across my path, and if I sidle past it, I'll subject my main line of reasoning to misunderstanding. So, I shall pause here, in order to give a brief statement of my opinion about it. In the government of the physical world, as distinct from the governments of the social or political world, it is observable that the female is, so far as strength is concerned, inferior to the male. This is the law of nature, and it doesn't seem to be suspended or repealed in favour of woman. This physical superiority can't be denied, and it is a noble privilege. But men, not content with this natural preeminence, try to sink us lower still, so as to make us merely alluring objects for a moment. And women, intoxicated by the adoration that men, under the influence of their senses, pay them, don't try to achieve a permanently important place in men's feelings, or to become the friends of the fellow creatures who find amusement in their society. I am aware of an obvious inference. From every direction I have heard protests against masculine women, but where are they to be found? If men are using this label in criticism of women's ardour in hunting, shooting, and gambling, I shall gladly join in. But if their target is the imitation of manly virtues, or, more accurately, the achieving of the talents and virtues that ennoble the human character, and raise females in the scale of animal being, when they are brought under the comprehensive label mankind, all those who view women with a philosophical eye must, I should think, join me in wanting women to grow more and more masculine every day. This discussion naturally divides the subject. I shall first consider women as human creatures who, in common with men, are placed on this earth to develop their abilities. And then I shall attend to the implications of the more specific label, women. I want to steer clear of an error that many writers have fallen into, namely, giving women instruction that has been appropriate for ladies. I shall address my sex in a firmer tone, focusing particularly on those in the middle class, because they appear to be in the most natural state. As for the upper classes, perhaps the great have always scattered seeds of false refinement, immorality, and vanity. Weak, artificial beings who have been prematurely and unnaturally raised above the ordinary wants and feelings of mankind undermine the very foundation of virtue and spread corruption through the whole mass of society. They have a stronger claim to pity than any other class of mankind. The upbringing of the rich tends to make them vain and helpless, and their unfolding minds are not strengthened by the practice of the duties that dignify the human character. They live only to amuse themselves, and, by a law that also operates in nature, they soon come to have nothing to offer except barren amusement. That is enough about that for the present. I plan to take the different ranks of society separately, and discuss the moral character of women in each. I have mentioned the subject of class differences here, only because I think that the essential task of an introduction is to give a sketchy account of the contents of the work it introduces. I hope my own sex will excuse me if I treat them like rational creatures, instead of flattering their fascinating graces, and viewing them as if they were in a state of perpetual childhood and unable to stand alone. I earnestly wish to point out what true dignity and human happiness consist in. I want to persuade women to aim at strength of mind and body, and to convince them that the soft phrases, susceptibility of heart, delicacy of sentiment, and refinement of taste, are almost synonymous with expressions indicating weakness, and that creatures who are the objects only of pity, and the kind of love that has been called pity's sister, will soon become objects of contempt. So I dismiss those pretty feminine phrases that the men condescendingly use to make our slavish dependence easier for us, and I despise the weak elegance of mind, exquisite sensibility, and sweet docility of manners that are supposed to be the sexual characteristics of the weaker sex. I want to show that elegance is inferior to virtue, that the most praiseworthy ambition is to obtain a character as a human being, whether male or female, and that lesser ambitions should be tested against that one. That is a rough sketch of my plan, and I offer now three remarks about how I aim to carry it out. 1. I shall refrain from pruning my phrases and polishing my style, because it is important to me to affect the thoughts and actions of my readers, and I'll do that better if I sometimes express my conviction with the energetic emotions that I feel. 2. I shan't waste time elegantly shaping my sentences, or fabricating the turgid bombast of artificial feelings that come from the head and therefore never reach the heart, because I want to persuade by the force of my arguments, rather than to dazzle by the elegance of my language. 3. I shall try to avoid the flowery diction that has slid from essays into novels, and from novels into familiar letters and conversation, because I'll be dealing with things, not words. In all this, I'll be anxious to turn my sex into members of society who are more worthy of respect. These pretty nothings, these caricatures of the real beauty of sensibility, drop glibly from the tongue, spoil one's sense of taste, and create a kind of sickly delicacy that turns away from simple unadorned truth. A deluge of false sentiments and overstretched feelings, stifling the natural emotions of the heart, make insipid the domestic pleasures that ought to sweeten the exercise of the severe duties that prepare a rational and immortal being for a nobler field of action. The education of women has been attended to more in recent years than formerly, but they're still regarded as a frivolous sex, and are ridiculed or pitied by writers who try to improve them by satire or instruction. It is acknowledged that they spend many of their earliest years acquiring a smattering of accomplishments, but strength of body and mind are sacrificed to libertine notions of beauty, to the desire to get themselves settled by marriage, the only way women can rise in the world. This desire makes mere animals of them, and when they marry, they act as such children can be expected to act. They dress, they paint, they give nicknames to God's creatures. Surely these weak beings are only fit for the seraglio. Can they govern a family with judgment, or take care of the poor babes whom they bring into the world? The present conduct of the female sex, its prevalent fondness for pleasure in place of ambition, and the nobler passions that open and enlarge the soul, are evidence that the instruction that women have received, with help from the constitution of civil society, has only tended to turn them into insignificant objects of desire, mere propagators of fools. If it can be proved that men, in aiming to bring women to perfection without cultivating their understandings, take them out of their sphere of real duties and make them ridiculous and useless when the brief bloom of beauty is over, I presume that rational men will excuse me for trying to persuade women to become more masculine and worthy of respect. Indeed, the word masculine is only a pointless scare word. There's little reason to fear that women will acquire too much courage or fortitude because their visible inferiority in bodily strength must make them to some extent dependent on men in the various relations of life. But why should that dependence be increased by prejudices that make virtue a different thing for the different sexes, and can't distinguish simple truths from sensual daydreams? Women are so much degraded by mistaken notions of female excellence that this artificial weakness produces in them a tendency to tyrannize and gives birth to cunning, the natural opponent of strength, which leads them to exploit those contemptible infantile airs that undermine esteem even while they excite desire. Let men become more chaste and modest, and if women don't become correspondingly wiser, it will be clear that they have weaker understandings. I hardly need to explain that I am talking about the female sex in general. Many individual women have more sense than their male relatives. Some women govern their husbands without degrading themselves, because intellect will always govern. Where there's a constant struggle for an equilibrium, nothing will swing the scales its way, unless it naturally has greater weight. End of introduction.